Whether it's palatial or closet size, squalid or opulent, New York apartments are a subject of fascination for most New Yorkers and many non-New Yorkers as well. Today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about the history and evolution of New York apartment living and what our apartments reveal about the culture of the city. And joining us now are Justin Davidson, the architecture and classical music critic at New York Magazine. His cover story in a special issue of his magazine this week is called A History of Vertical Living. Also with us is James Sanders, an architect and author of Celluloid Skyline, New York in the Movies, co-writer of the PBS series New York, a documentary film. And I'm pleased to see you again, James.
Thank you.
So where does the word apartment come from?
Well, it means apart. It's an old word that comes just from rooms in a larger building, be it a palace, a place you can retreat to. It's not the word that was in use when the first apartments in New York were when the apartment was developing in New York.
Well, either, they came from Paris, didn't they, or some?
They did, and they were called French flats.
Uh-huh. And in France, they were developed for the rich.
Yeah, I mean, apartments have been around in any dense city and even in villages all over the world for hundreds of years. There was nothing innovative about just creating the apartment. It was about adapting it to New York.
And what were the first apartments built in New York?
Well, the first one that's commonly thought of as a modern-day apartment is the Stuyvesant Apartments, which was designed by Richard Morris Hunt, very well-known architect. It was built near Gramercy Park. And, of course, we need to make clear there were multiple dwellings in New York way before the Stuyvesant was built in the late 1860s. They were called tenements, and they were the place the poor lived. So the real distinction for the apartment, in a way, is a class distinction more than an architectural distinction. It's the first multiple dwelling for middle-class people.
And were the Stuyvesant apartments spacious? Were they the kind of place that wealthy people would want to live?
They were, although we were speaking about this before. The initial people who lived in apartments, and including the Stuyvesant, were not so much the really old line New York wealthy families. You would more be people like bachelors, young, well-to-do young men in New York would have their own place. And it was considered a transition apartment between, let's say, the mansion you grew up in and the mansion you might eventually or townhouse you might eventually live in. But while you had just gotten out of Yale or something like that, you lived in an apartment.
Were the tenements mostly railroad flats?
They were. There was a series of developments in the tenement as Progressive tried to bring more light and air into what was an incredibly cramped situation. If you go to the Tenement Museum today, you can see exactly the way it developed over years. It meant packing an enormous number of people and activities because they were really live workspaces. The front room was a place for the family industry to take place.
Were they in response to the burgeoning immigrant population of New York?
They were. The population of New York after the Civil War especially was growing more rapidly than the city could really accommodate. And even though there was plenty of space at that point to move up the island of Manhattan and even into the boroughs, and there were even people who lived in the suburbs or in neighboring villages and commuted, it was clear that most people needed to live close to where they worked or close to each other. And it was a rapidly densifying city, and they needed that kind of architecture.
And for people with money, at least the ones in Manhattan, it seemed important to live near the park, a reason that we see so many fancy apartment houses on Central Park West, Fifth Avenue, and Park Avenue?
Well, that was following an older tradition, which was the mansion tradition, had begun on Fifth Avenue. And then when Central Park opened around it just on the eve of the Civil War, and particularly in the years after the Civil War, you had this explosion of mansions reaching all the way up to about 90th Street, 93rd Street, where the Cooper Hewitt is now, was the old Carnegie House, and Frick Mansion, of course. And so that quickly established Fifth Avenue as the most desirable address in the city. And so, interestingly, apartments were not allowed on Fifth Avenue till way after 1900. On the West Side, which was not as fashionable, there were no such restrictions. And very quickly, Central Park West developed as an apartment house avenue, not what the buildings we think of today. Most of the buildings that are there today replaced earlier apartment houses.
But a building like the Dakota was called the Dakota because it seemed to be as far away as you could ever imagine.
So the story goes.
Not true?
Well, there's debate about it. You can ask Chris Gray. But yes, of course, the Dakota was built as a sort of self-contained, almost urban island way up on 72nd Street.
And then Riverside Drive became another fashionable place to live. But we have apartment buildings all over the city and all the boroughs. Did they develop in the same way? Wasn't the Bronx an apartment building borough to a large degree for people who wanted to escape the tenements of Manhattan?
It was. If you look at the history of the apartment, it's really develops for different groups of people at different times with different ideas. So in the 19th century, you have the apartment as a lure for the middle class, for the wealthy, for different groups of immigrant people who are moving out of the really dense, crowded Lower East Side and trying to find other enclaves where they can live essentially the same way, but more spaciously, more comfortably, with more access to greenery.
Is there something we spoke recently to someone who said that New York City is greener, actually, than a small town because of the efficiency of apartment buildings and such? You're nodding your head, James.
That's quite right. That any building where you take a subway to, you know, come and go, or a bus, is almost intrinsically more efficient, no matter how it's built, than a building which you need to use a car to get to and from.
But what about the building itself? The fact that you share plumbing and you share electrical wiring and
absolutely, there are efficiencies of construction, which is that your ceiling is someone else's floor, so to speak, and then there are efficiencies of heating. For example, your heat is not going to waste as it does in a suburban house to heat the air around you, but rather heating the next apartment. And finally, efficiencies of dense urban living.
Well, and this was quite obvious to people even in the late 19th century. They weren't thinking about it in terms of sustainability, but they certainly were thinking about it in terms of cost and technology. It meant that you could amortize the cost of adding new technologies to the architecture: steam heat, vacuum cleaning, laundry, food preparation. All those things could be collectivized.
We invite listener calls. Our number here is 646-829-3985. That's 646-829-3985. We're also getting comments on our show page at WNYC.org. Before we get to all of that, did people buy apartments from the beginning, or when did the idea of the co-op and the condo come
That's a out? Rather – well, the cooperative is a rather sort of somewhat an interesting and somewhat controversial story, because basically cooperative is a club. It's a home club, and indeed the original cooperatives were called exactly that. They were called home clubs, and many people have said that really it was a – kind of way to exert social control in the late 19th century, specifically in regard to the rising number of well-to-do Jewish people in New York who would be able to buy their way in if it were just a matter of money. And cooperatives, to some degree, were created as a way that you could basically, like any club, keep people out that you didn't want in. And that was one of the attractions of them.
So they could keep people out because of their religion, or if they were actors, we're still seeing that in some cases. The co-op board can deny them the sale of an apartment even if they have the money?
Absolutely.
It was also a way of taking the sting out of paying somebody else for the housing if you were an upper middle class family. And interestingly enough, it was very difficult to make it financially successful. The Central Park apartments, who were developed by Navarro in the 1880s, went bust.
Margaret in Brooklyn shares her apartment story with us. She said, I lived in an apartment on the first floor of a building built in 1929. The bedroom had a window on the dark, dank air shaft, but there was also a window that looked out on the living room. What's up with that? The window was real, like there was an apparatus for sashes, but it had no glass when I was there.
She's probably describing an old law tenement. The old law was passed in 1879 to improve on the even worse tenements that came before it. But that's where you got that very distinctive shaped, narrow air shaft. And then they, to try to improve ventilation, they actually created openings between the rooms.
Well, we've been talking a lot during the housing crisis about the desire of people to own their own homes. An apartment seems to be the alternative, and yet these days we're seeing More and more apartments being created in New York, especially out of old factory buildings, loft buildings. Downtown Manhattan, we have the financial district seems to be moving, becoming a residential area as well. So has the idea of the apartment changed over the years?
It's changed many times, and repurposing a different kind of building for apartment living was also something that was happening in the 19th century. Single-family houses were being divided up for boarding houses. Mansions were being divided up into boarding houses and apartments. And part of the whole push to apartment building was to create purpose-built apartments.
I would say that the loft, however, in the post-war loft in the 1950s and 60s, which began in Lower Manhattan, was one of New York's great gifts to the world. New York invented the idea of, in a big way, of taking industrial spaces and turning them into live-work space.
Well, one of the inducements to move into a place is that it's pre-war. But I'm wondering which war we're talking about in some cases with the loft conversions. That would be pre-Iraq War, wouldn't it? Pre-Afghan War?
Well, the buildings, of course, the old industrial buildings are generally, in fact, from before the big one, before 1945 or 1940.
Do they convert well? In Cobble Hill, they're now converting a church into housing. I can't imagine how high the ceilings will be.
People have been turning all sorts of buildings into – lofts make wonderful – they're universal space, they're very wide bay, and they can be worked out. You do usually have some issue, which is that the center of the building tends to be a little dark.
One of the things that's interesting about the period after the first wave of loft conversions was how the idea of the loft, this open space that looks industrial, got exported to other kinds of buildings, including new buildings, so that you get the creation of new loft-like buildings, which are meant to emulate the readaptation of old buildings that weren't meant to be lived in at all.
Because it suggests that they're unlike the older apartments, which were a lot of little, like a warren, a rabbit warren, a bunch of little rooms.
I would actually say that they became associated, thanks in part to the movies, with a certain kind of stylish New York life in the 1970s and 80s, that cool people, hip people lived in these interesting wide open spaces with open kitchens and open areas that, well, they could be an artist.
So is this something you suggest that is exported to other cities? Would people building similar kinds of apartment houses in Chicago, which has its own great
architectural tradition? You'll see the phrase loft style. In Dallas and Fort Worth and places like that, loft-style architecture, by which they mean new condominium developments.
A listener, Eric in Manhattan, writes in, I didn't live in this apartment, but when I was apartment hunting several years ago, I got a tour of a makeshift apartment that was created from a garage. The owner purchased the standalone garage and set up drywall to partition the space. He had a tub in the quote, bathroom, a small electric stove in the quote, kitchen. There were no windows in the entire apartment except for two that were the owner's bedroom. And that was in Williamsburg, and it probably was not, didn't come cheap at that point.
And it was probably illegal.
So is there a way we can even know whether an apartment is legal or illegal?
The Department of Buildings tries very hard, but it is, in fact, something that happened, I think, in the last 20 years is that there's a new kind of Jacob Riis thing that's going on, which people don't talk much about, but all across the boroughs, I think all sorts of buildings have been converted. People are living in basements and stuff, not dissimilarly in some cases to the way people lived around the turn of the 20th century.
And should we be concerned in a basement? Aren't there some that you're not allowed to sleep in because of the boilers down there or the heating system?
Well, we should certainly be concerned if an apartment conversion is not legal because that means it's not up to code and that means its wiring may not be safe and it's not getting proper ventilation.
Lisa in Brooklyn says, my 35-unit building in Brooklyn was built in the 1920s and all the apartments had dumbwaiters. What were they used for?
Well, I don't know about that building specifically, but dumbwaiters were predated elevators. In many cases. And in the really fancy buildings, they were often used to bring food up or down from the communal dining room, where if you didn't want to take your meal with all the other residents in the building, you could have essentially takeout packed up and lifted up to your apartment.
Francis in Manhattan writes, I live in the same apartment in which I grew up. It's a tenement apartment with a bathtub in the kitchen. I lived here with four siblings, two parents, and a dog as I grew up. Now I live here with a husband and a daughter. When my daughter was a young child, the bathtub in the kitchen was a great advantage. I could cook and watch her taking a bath at the same time. Now, not so much of an advantage. One wonderful thing about our three little rooms, Railroad Apartment, it's on the corner building, so there are windows along the entire length of it. So
those apartments, when they were built, of course, had no bathroom in the apartment at all. The only they had a toilet. Well, in the original buildings, it would have been an outhouse in the back, and that continued right up to the 1930s. Then they added outhouses in the back, and then they had toilets in the hallway.
And then apartments on the floor shared them.
There was a big deal, a big, big achievement of the LaGuardia administration was when they absolutely forced every tenement owner to put a toilet and a bathtub in the apartment, and there was nowhere to put them. So that's where the bathtubs ended up in the kitchen.
That was an issue even in the luxury apartments where you might have an 11-room apartment with one small bathroom.
Adam in Sunset Park asks, can you explain the history of Finnish co-ops, especially in Sunset Park? Do you know about them?
No.
A listener asks, was there a plan for the major boulevards in the city, or did they develop organically based on whoever had the money to buy buildings?
Well, the big boulevards, like you think of the Grand Concourse, would be the best example, were planned, and they were first imagined to be sort of big Victorian-style houses. But by the 19-teens and 20s, you got this great sort of ramparts of apartment houses being built, all shaped to the same zoning law, which then made them sort of have all roughly the same height, and you got those sort of wonderful vistas of Art Deco architecture.
What about subsidized housing and the projects? At one point, they seemed like a really good idea. They haven't always turned out to be so ideal.
They haven't, but I think the history of subsidized housing is more mixed than you would sometimes think, looking at the iconic image of the failed policy of subsidized housing or public housing is Pruitt-Igoe in St. Louis, and it was dynamited, and it was seen as really the epitaph for a whole era of public housing. But the reality is that, especially in New York, public housing has often been very successful.
I would venture that, in fact, New York has been more successful in part because we have an apartment house tradition. The idea of living in apartment houses for middle-class people or even the rich is not so uncommon.
Well, what does a city's way of housing its people say about it? What does our style of living in New York say about who we are or how we would like to see ourselves?
Well, I would say that many of the things people love most about New York, but specifically the energy of street life in New York, is really based on apartment houses. You don't have the bodies on the street if people are living in suburban style housing. You just need those kind of stacked up buildings to create that energy.
Well, some boroughs have a lot more apartment housing than others. Is that because people who wanted one family homes were more likely to gravitate toward Queens or Staten Island? And, well, I guess the brownstones of Brooklyn are one-family homes or were one-family homes. Now they're all apartment buildings of a sort, aren't they?
Well, and some are being reconverted to one-family homes. But there's a very strong connection between density and public transportation. So the areas that are largely one-family homes are less accessible to public transportation. One of the keys to the success of New York has been its extensive public transportation system, which you can't have without the kind of high-rise construction that New York really developed with.
Have you seen an apartment that you were particularly stunned by? Are there some that are really extraordinary here in New York?
I think there's never really been an era like the pre-war, the really luxury apartment buildings of the early part of the 20th century. That's a kind of living that has never really been recaptured. It came to an end with the Depression.
That's because the apartments were kind of like houses within a building.
That's right.
And they had all of the things that you would want from a private home, except that they were not – and in many cases, they had a floor to themselves as well.
Well, that was where the term flats came from. They were not townhouses which used staircases. They had everything on one floor, but they in many cases took up the entire floor and thus had all the accoutrements of a townhouse in a single level.
I want to thank both of you so much for being with us. The article in this week's New York Magazine is called A History of Vertical Living, written by Justin Davidson, the architecture and classical music critic. I think they do go together, I think, at that magazine. And James Sanders is an architect who's visited us before to talk about both architecture and his book Celluloid Skyline, New York and the Movies. Also, the PBS series New York, a documentary film. It's been a great pleasure having both of you, and we thank all of our listeners who have written in to contribute to this. I'm sure many of them live in apartments.
Thank you.
Thank you.